concrete hospital floor bent over his goddamn plastic crib hospital bed that stank of sickness and sterility. Meanwhile, Finn still couldn't breathe on his own and was intubated in intensive care. I was apoplectic. I couldn't take it anymore. A dermatologist came in to check out the burns and give me some cream to treat his wounds. But now, holding him was out of the question, due to the extent and position of the burns. Once again, I demanded that someone get to the bottom of how my son had been harmed in this way. Eventually, after incident reports, patient advocacy departments, and much harrying and nagging of his doctors and nurses, they finally discovered what had caused the burns. Before surgery, they'd used a routine antibacterial gel to clean Finn's body. There just happens to be a very, very small percentage of people who have an allergic reaction to it, which causes the skin to burn under the application spot. And guess who was allergic? That's right, none other than my little Cocopelli, Finnegan Roy. Finn was always the 1%, as in 99 times out of 100, this never fails. Don't speak too soon. Have you met my boy? It seemed to take forever. But at last the burn started healing, and despite all odds, sometimes his 1% went both ways, they were finally able to extubate Finn. It was still touch and go, and we almost lost him again, but eventually Finn pulled through and was able to breathe on his own with the help from the trach. Although he did fight it, just as I knew he would, so the docs decided we could let him off the machine whenever he was awake, as long as we monitored his oxygen levels. Have you ever tried to get an O2 reading from a baby? It's like trying to blow zeros when you're still drunk. Those chip-clip fingertip clamps don't fit their sweaty little digits and are constantly slipping off and making the machine peep a heart-stopping false alarm. And so, after a month in the hospital over Christmas during yet another cold-as-balls Michigan winter, and after being taught how to take care of his various ports and buttons and monitor his oxygen levels, here, try some of this medical tape that will keep his pulsometer on for an extra 30 seconds before he slips it off and the machine starts beeping that he's got no oxygen and you come running and, whoopsie-doopsie daddy, did I give you a scare? After all that, and after learning how to clean and maintain his pumps and pulsometers and brainometers and so much medical jargon that all these years later I can't keep it straight, eventually, after all that, I took him home. With the addition of a small mobile hospital's worth of equipment. But he was finally home, in his own bed, with his menagerie of stuffed lambs and birds. We were home. For good. At this point, I knew he didn't have much left in him, and neither did I. We had done all we could. Finterlude. Summer. The 90s. Before Finn. That was intense. I know. Let's take a little break from Finn's story and head back in time to the gnarly 90s, where we can visit little tween Luke at Shakespeare Camp in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. My parents are unique, brilliant creatives who never let that get in the way of taking care of our family. They were both actors, writers, directors, and college theater instructors. And while money was always tight, they worked incredibly hard to give me and my two older brothers a wonderful childhood, full of theater, travel, and adventure. Early on, they both decided to get their master's degrees and teach at a college level so they could provide a more stable environment for us boys, instead of constantly running around the country doing 6-week stints at regional theaters. By the time I came along, we were relatively ensconced in Michigan, but they could still act and direct at theaters all over the country in the summer when we were all off from school, and they did, bringing me along for the ride. In my early teens, we spent a few summers in the Berkshire Mountains, where my parents were actors for the legendary Shakespeare and Company, which at the time was still located on the expansive grounds of American author Edith Wharton's historic home. The Mount, was built by the supremely fascinating Ms. Warden and her husband, who created beauty and structure from chaos. That's how I see my grief and my compulsion to tell this story. I need to build my grief into a beautiful house of memory and devotion to Finn. Warden's structure was a historic and visual feast. Imagine a gorgeous, sprawling, slightly crumbling mansion with classical Italian and French influences. The whole estate surrounded by vast meadows and lush, deep green forests, meticulous gardens, and ponds, lakes, and foothills as far as the eye can see. Kind of like an American Downton Abbey. I would serve refreshments on the back patio during intermission while the actors performed plays and ghost stories by Warden and Henry James, all against the backdrop of the mansion's gently sagging facade and beautiful Victorian rooms. At night, supernatural tales abounded from people who'd stayed in the house and felt presences or seen dark shadows. This all captured my imagination and set it on fire. I loved hearing about the history, but mostly I just loved sitting in it and looking at the old wallpaper and elegant wainscoting and wondering what it would feel like to live in another time. To be another person. That desire to feel things from a different point of view has served me well in the storytelling I now find myself doing for a living. During the school year, I went to a private school that I'm sure my parents couldn't afford, but somehow they did it for all three of us. However, most of the other students came from the kind of wealthy families that gave their kids their old BMWs and Land Rovers without a second thought. I never felt like I fit in there. And this was never more evident than when I had to drive our family's janky old beat-up Red Dodge Caravan to school. Now, I know what you're thinking. I should have been grateful for any sort of transportation at that age. But try telling that to a 17-year-old me who's desperately trying to start that dented red beast after school in the parking lot while about 300 of my fellow classmates head for their cars. Oh, and there's usually like 3 feet of snow. You know, the kind of snow that peacefully mutes everything, except for the screeching sound coming from my boxy red beast as I crank the key and mash the brake while wildly looking around and saying, "Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please. Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please. Hi, Daniels. You need a lift, bro? No, I'm good, dude. Okay, bro. You're lost because we got my mom's Rover, and we're rovering over to Jenny's. Good luck, Kiki." High school. So come summertime, I was usually okay with the idea of blowing town and going somewhere far away from those problems. Funny, but this ignited a desire in me to keep moving. But first, we had the journey to get there. My family and I would pack up some clothes and a box of pots and pans and dishware, and of course my trusty tape recorder, and travel from Michigan to Lenox, Massachusetts, which felt like another country with its winding roads with names like Old Devil Hollow and Bent Back Lane, and everywhere nooks and crannies filled with mystery, history, and magic. And what was our mode of transportation? Why, our trusty red caravan, of course, perpetually rusting at the edges, but nonetheless, our home away from home. If you haven't traveled cross-country in a loud, slow automobile with your entire family and without the aid of electronic distractions, then you haven't really lived. Wait, sorry, that should have read, then you haven't really felt true boredom. We survived on peanut butter sandwiches, the license plate game, sibling rivalry, surprise unclaimed farts, and cheap motels. These trips may have been long and arduous, but we always made it in the end, and I wouldn't trade a moment of them now. When we finally arrived in the devastatingly beautiful Berkshires, we were put up in the theater's actor housing. Since this is audio, I'm not sure you got the air quotes, but trust me, they were there. I say housing because while our living quarters were situated in a different place each summer, they were all the same in that it was communal living in some random crumbling structure of dubious quality. But we were the lucky ones. Compared to what the actors without families were put up in, ours seemed downright cozy. For instance, down a gravel drive from the creepily quaint little cottage where we lived one summer was a large building that looked very much like a terrifying old insane asylum. In fact, my older brothers both assured me it was, so I knew it had to be true. However, despite its possibly, probably, definitely dubious origins, this old home was actually striking, with its sagging windows and peeling paint motif, and it now housed a number of young, enthusiastic actors who provided a lively backdrop of Nine Inch Nails and Ultimate Frisbee to our comings and goings that summer. Our accommodations were just as ramshackle, but much more mundane by comparison. Aside from the interrogation room, with a single swinging bulb and chair that my brothers and I had discovered in the basement, lending the whole place an air of past intrigue. These were carefree, beautiful days filled with adventure and exploration. But summer days are long, and my parents were busy day and night performing in several shows at once. So, in an effort to take part in such an exciting environment and make some much-needed scratch for my comic addiction, I started working at the theater myself. Now, I was like 10 when I started, mind you, and I was getting paid minimally under the table to help with odd jobs around the expansive grounds. I was particularly good at slinging t-shirts from the concession stand before the outdoor shows. It was here I started learning about business and that I enjoyed taking part in it. Well, I liked getting paid, mostly. But I also appreciated the strain it took off my parents, who with three young kids were always short on cash. And I really loved the feeling of being independent that working gave me. My enthusiasm paid off, and I soon found myself in charge of my own concession stand outside one of the smaller theaters, where I was also in charge of inventory, ordering and stocking concessions, dealing with customers, and picking up cigarette butts out of gravel driveways. You know, normal 10-year-old stuff. This was also where I learned that theaters never have enough money, and they have to be very frugal to survive. It made me feel that theater people were tough, especially since not everyone appreciates the value that artists bring to our culture. But by far the most terrifying job I had was answering phones, alone, after hours, in Edith Wharton's actual haunted mansion. I'd always felt a sense of wonder and fascination at the Mount. But these feelings were finally tested as one of the young actors led me upstairs to the very top floor of the mansion to show me around for my first shift as the company's pseudo-after-hours-but-under-the-table answering service. Up here, this area of the mansion used to be the servants' quarters. Really? Cool. Yep. Here's your desk, and that's the phone. Just write down any messages on this pad and put them in the right mailbox here, okay? Oh, and right over there, you see that room that's literally directly across from the desk you'll be sitting at by yourself all night? Well, it's crazy, but I guess a long time ago one of the maids hanged herself in the doorway to that room. Crazy, right? Apparently people have seen her ghost, too. Anyway, that's it. Job's pretty simple. I'll leave you to it. The theater. I was hooked. Those summer days, something just a little different and unexpected was always happening. Actors ran through woods hooting and keening. Men in dresses lay in meadows with flowers clutched to their chests, watching passing clouds with hopeful hearts. Solstices were celebrated, lovers wound and bound, and the words of Shakespeare were panted and uttered, screamed and incanted, studied and celebrated. Although I didn't realize it at the time, I had a secret window into a true artist's enclave, and while I didn't know what it was at 10 years old, I did know I was witnessing something special. Through my parents' passion, I saw artistry legitimized. We were always broke, but they still pursued their dreams while finding a way to make ends meet, and they taught me about hard work through their example. Part of our regular chores at home, in addition to things like taking out the trash and doing the dishes, was running lines with my parents. I remember finding it incredibly tedious and awkward, so I would try to liven things up. Dad. Okay, Luker, let's start with Act 4, Scene 3. Me. Long, protracted sigh.
Fine.
Dad.
Now, I'm still learning these, so you're gonna have to help me out a little. But don't say the line unless I ask you for it, okay? So only give me the line if I say line, okay?
Me. Longer, protracted sigh.
Okay. Not my first rodeo, Dad.
Dad.
Yeah, no, you're right, okay. So we'll start with the line, "We're in my letters, praying on his side, because I knew the man were slided off." You see that?
Me.
Yeah. Dad. Great. You say that, and then I'll say my line and we'll go as far as I can.
Me. I got it, Dad.
Dad. Okay. Go for it, then.
Me. In an amazingly thick Scottish brogue.
We're in my letters, praying on his side, because I knew the man were slated off.
Dad.
Interesting choice, and very clever, but that's kind of distracting to me. Can you do it normal?
Me.
Ugh, is there any word worse than normal? Gag me with a spoon, Dad. And interesting is an interesting word. If you could use any other word than interesting, what would it be?
Dad.
Annoying. I say annoying. Now let's try again, please.
Me. In extreme monotone.
We're in my letters, praying on his side, because I knew the man were slighted off.
Dad.
You wronged yourself to write such a case.
Me. Triumphant.
No, it's actually you wronged yourself to write in such a case. You didn't say in.
Dad.
Okay. Thank you. You wronged yourself to write in such a case.
Strange, but this persnickety and, yes, annoying nature would become important much later, as I would parse through scripts and narrate in the never-ending quest to be word-perfect.
Dad. It's your line. Pay attention.
Me.
Oh. Then in a reedy German accent.
In such a time as this, it is not meet that every nice offense should bear his comment.
Dad.
Long, protracted sigh. You know, I think I'll just work on these alone for a bit.
Despite not always being the best helper, my family never failed to help me whenever I needed it. And though none of us were prepared for the turmoil Finn's illness caused, they were right there with me the whole time. After his tracheostomy and during that last winter of Finn's life, I would need them more than ever.
Will you go, laddie, go?
Part 6. Winter, 2015. During Finn. As I had feared, Finn didn't tolerate the new machines well, and his health continued to worsen. He had scratches all over his face from constantly trying to both tear out his trach and scratch off his nose. Wanting to pull the trach out, I understood. I wanted to as well. But the nose was new. It looked like how I feel when I have allergies and I get that annoying tingling sensation, but it also seemed like a possible neurological tick. We just didn't know. But between that and the coughing and all the tubes, we ended up having to swaddle him with a blankie to pin his arms down. And he'd still find a way to get them out. He actually had a lot of strength when it came to pulling out his tubes and creating havoc. He was in a constant state of agitation and discomfort. And I saw less and less of his big blue eyes as his personality faded. It was then that the voice in my head started to say, "No more. No more." It told me that he had suffered enough. That maybe this time should become less about keeping him alive and more about keeping him comfortable. It was then I learned the word hospice. And more importantly, I learned what it meant. It meant comfort in that final transition. It meant care and understanding. It meant no more fighting but listening. What does he need? How can I ease his suffering? It meant appreciating what time I had left with him and preparing for his inevitable death. For so long, I had been utterly and entirely immersed in his care. At first in a desperate attempt to figure out what was wrong, then trying to fight back, and finally just trying to keep him alive. For 21 months, we fought. And then, just like that, the war was over. It was time to lay down my sword and pick up my son. And hold him, and sing to him, and tell him over and over how special he was. and try to find some way to finally bring him some measure of comfort. There were many people who tried to help Finn on his journey, but there was one very special doctor who came into Finn's story near the end and offered a quality of care that we were desperate for. After everything we'd been through, I found it very easy to listen to him, because he listened to me. He heard me when I said, "Finn needs peace." And he said, "You're right. And there's no reason for him to suffer any longer. You've done all you can for him." He was in charge of the hospital's hospice program, and he and his team brought us much-needed support at the end of my son's life. They told us it was okay to give Finn comfort, that it was time to stop poking and prodding and feeding and pushing. Now, for what little time we had left, it was only about making him comfortable for his transition. That's what I began to see his death as, a transformation, an ascendance out of his pain and strife, and into peace and comfort. He would finally be free. But we didn't know when, exactly, just that it was coming. So we waited. I waited. He waited. And I watched him. I watched him and I waited. As always. And because there was nothing left for me to do, I just tried to be present with him. Over the next few weeks, we fed him less and less. His color grew grayer. His limbs lost what little strength they'd had. I knew his time was coming. He rarely woke, and when he did, it wasn't for long. But there were moments when the fog of pain and anguish cleared, and I got to see his eyes again, and he saw me, and we both knew what lay ahead. My family came from all over the country to spend his last days together. It was such a gift. We took turns holding him and singing to him, and our family priest came by to pray over him and offer last rites. This final trauma of not just letting him go, but watching him go, was tempered by the many hands that lent their support. We all bore that weight together. It was Sunday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, and, as usual, it was cold and gray in Michigan. My family and I were in the living room, and my sister-in-law just finished singing "Wild Mountain Time" in a soft, clear voice, and all of a sudden a quietness fell over us. Time seemed to stretch out. It felt like he was going. I can't explain it. The watching and waiting and listening told everyone in the room that possibly, maybe, his last breaths were coming. And while I'm ashamed to admit it, I felt impatience and doubt. Cynicism and anguish bubbled up. I heard a voice, not that voice, but a cold and dark one, that whispered, "I wish he'd get it over with already. I can't watch this. I need it to end. Please let this be the end." I know now that it's normal to feel those things after so much trauma, but for me it also symbolizes just how utterly destroyed I was. After all that time fighting and worrying, I wanted to give up. But I didn't. How could I? He never did. So I pulled myself back out of those black thoughts and focused once more on Finn. The room was still quiet, and his breathing had slowed, with long gaps between breaths that left us wondering, was that it? Is he gone? Only to have my Cocopelli take another breath, and we would all let ours out and shake our heads and chuckle at the awfulness of the situation. I don't know who first did it, but I suspect it was one of my parents. One by one, we all reached out and put our hands on his frail body, keeping them there, overlapping because he was so small. And we all just breathed in silence with him. I don't know how to explain what happened next. Maybe it was simply his neurons firing randomly, as my skeptic voice likes to postulate. But he took in a breath
and actually opened his eyes, really opened them. It had been a while since I had seen any sign of awareness from him. But all of a sudden, his eyes were not only open, but wide open. But his focus was not on us any longer. He was looking up and past all of us as we held him, looking at something no one else in the room could see. As he did, his body became rigid and his back arched slightly. I'm not an easy believer. I'm a natural skeptic. But damned if it didn't look for all the world like his spirit was leaving his body. I cannot explain it. I can only bear witness to it and tell the story. After only a minute or two, this passed, and his eyes closed again and his breathing slowed even more. Everyone had seen what had happened, and there was still electricity in the air. I'm left believing that this was his final goodbye. A sign that there is more to this world than we can see with our eyes. Another gift from Finn to show me that I need to believe in more than just myself. After that episode, he didn't wake up again. And Finn eventually passed early the next morning at 6:30 a.m. But I believe he was already gone, and that those final hours were just his utterly exhausted body shutting down. I also think it goes to show how freaking tough this kid was. Even after his spirit was gone, his body was still fighting, still surviving, still trying.
Behold, I am a soldier boy.
Finterlude. The Roaring Twenties. After Finn. Grief is definitely a club. In all senses. It beats you down like a club. And it's a club I'm a part of that I never wanted to belong to. It's like the mafia. Once you're in for life, kid. But now it can sometimes feel like a badge of honor, my grief. And other times it feels like a scarlet letter. Like people can see that I've lost my child. They can see that I failed him. All these years later, I also find that I have to be careful not to judge people who haven't experienced their own grief. I find myself gravitating to other people who are in the grief club because they can truly understand the pain. Those who've gone through their own personal tragedy just get it. But it's still hard to talk about grief. Even with someone who can understand loss, it can feel overwhelming and like there are things we should and shouldn't say. It's like Fight Club. And what's the first rule of Fight Club? We don't talk about Fight Club. But we still need to talk about it. I need to talk about it. You need to talk about it. So let's talk about grief. If you find yourself in a situation where someone is grieving, there's no right thing to say. It's the effort of engaging that person about it that counts. I find it also helps when people ask his name. Saying his name keeps him alive through sound. In addition to depression and addiction, my grief has also been very much physical, and my deterioration has been acute. This is gross, but there was a time when basic functions, like brushing my teeth, seemed like too much to handle. I couldn't even convince myself to do it while peeing. I've gained weight, started smoking, stopped exercising. I've started to walk with a shuffle when I'm tired and have the after couch crouch upon getting up from the sofa. Don't even get me started on putting on socks and shoes or any kind of bending over in general. I will literally go out of my way not to have to bend down. I no longer have a core, more like a general undefined area of sag. I also have an irregular sleep schedule, stress-induced migraines, and a barely functioning stomach. I can no longer drink beer, which is a blessing in disguise. I stay away from gluten, I take medication, I'm on antidepressants, and I have to sleep on a giant wedge so I don't drown in my sleep apnea. There's most likely a CPAP machine in my future, especially if I don't quit smoking. It's been over 4 years since Finn passed. In that time, I've recorded another EMB of books. I've managed to keep myself sober and out of trouble with the law. I bought a house with a few acres. And I've found better ways to deal with my grief. I still struggle every day, but time has helped soften some of the edges. but I have come to realize that I need some sort of memorial for Finn. My grandparents all passed when I was younger, and I particularly remember seeing my maternal grandmother in her casket at her funeral. I was 6, and it just didn't seem real. But I knew I was seeing something real. Even then, I heard that voice saying, "Pay attention to this. This is important. This is life in its purest form." Her death was the first time I can remember seeing my dad cry. They were close, and she was soft in all the ways his mom had been hard. Dorothea, Mom's mom, was a force to be reckoned with in the best way possible. She made an impression on me even though I only saw her a few times. And she is also my earliest memory of noticing someone's voice. She was from Boston and called me Lovey Luke, and she was a warrior queen for her time. I remember thinking I liked how she said Lovey Luke, or how she called my granddad Fosta. And I remember imitating her, trying to sound like her in my room, under my covers, saying, "Pak Fosta's ka in Harvard Yard, Lovey Luke." Dorothea was a World War II nurse, and one time she and a bunch of other nurses were accidentally dropped into Anzio ahead of any soldiers. Legend has it she had a love affair with an Italian pilot who was later killed. Apparently she had also ditched her military-issue gas mask so she could keep her evening gown in its container instead. Oh, gee, Queen. After she died, I was given a small cut-glass jewelry box of hers, filled with a pearl necklace and a letter she'd written me. I used to open it and hold her jewelry and remember her voice, and it even smelled like her. I still have it to this day. It's one of those touchstones that connect me to my past. This small box allowed me to feel close to someone I loved, even after they'd gone. These touchstones carry so much energy, and I need them now for Finn. But the part I've yet to deal with is his remains, as in what to do with them. Let me back up. Before Finn's death, I never really gave much thought to what happens to our bodies when we die. Personally, I've never been particularly interested in the idea of being buried. The whole process seems illogical. Putting my body, which is essentially nothing more than compost at this point, into an expensive box? Which, I might add, is lined with equally expensive plush fabric and padding. Because why? I certainly won't be able to appreciate it. Then we're going to bury this box a couple yards underground and put a rock with my name on top. Then people can come and look at that rock and cry. Meanwhile, my body is slowly becoming some shriveled horror show a few feet below. Nah. So I always jumped on the cremation bandwagon. I mean, it seems pretty reasonable. Take your loved one's body, which again is a ticking time bomb of decomposition, and throw it in a brick oven until it's ash. Which, spoiler alert, the human body makes a lot of ash. And it's not one consistency, meaning the ash is kind of chunky. I'm sorry, but somebody has to say it. These were things I did not know going into the process. The result is that the family is now left with a pouch of human remains about the size of the bag Indiana Jones uses to take the golden idol from the booby-trapped pedestal at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, at this point, there are pretty much three options. Option A, place your loved one's carbon deposit in a fancy or funky memorial container, and from there display either prominently or discreetly, dealer's choice. Option B, you spread the ashes. Spread them. Yeah, like Johnny Deathseed. Now, if you pick this option, there is the vital issue of where. Yes, where indeed are you going to dump this human dust bomb? Then what do you do with a leftover container? Just throw it out? Is there an FB Marketplace listing for used urns? Lastly, option C. This is any alternative crazy thing you see on your social feed. For example, turn your loved one into a tree, place them in glass to be forever frozen like Han Solo or the bad dudes from Superman. Any kind of option you can think of, really. From the "that's actually metal and awesome" option, like comic book writer gets ashes put into ink to be printed in comic books, to the still metal but slightly creepy dude gets girlfriend's ashes tattooed into his skin. That's actually the plot of a book I narrated. Only he gets superpowers and can talk to the dead.
It was a good book. These thoughts still run rampant through my grief-stricken mind 4 years after I've already made the decision. I wasn't prepared then. And now I'm left saying, wait, is that what I really wanted to have happen to him? Why didn't I create some kind of physical memorial? Now, I would love to be able to stand over a rock dedicated to him and cry. Why had I been so cavalier about it before? For a while, I thought maybe a bench in a park close by would give me the physical space I craved to go sit and remember him. And then I realized I already have that. I have a new home with a beautiful backyard I can fill with flowers and create the memorial Finn and I both deserve. He loved birdsong. For whatever reason, it always soothed him. And whenever I see birds, especially cardinals, I often find myself listening to them and talking to him. To me, he is the cardinal, hopping from branch to branch, singing his song, free from pain and suffering. So what I really want is to create a bird sanctuary in my own backyard where I can listen to the birds with him. In the meantime, I've been getting by with other physical touchstones that remind me of him. As an actor, I've learned to use physical items like props and costumes to help ground me in the reality of the world I'm creating. So, too, I find with my grief. I need something physical to hold on to. I miss the weight of him in my arms, the way he rested on my shoulder, the feel of his sweaty hands and stinky feet. I want, more than anything, to hold him again. But I can't. So I have to rely on what's left behind to fill that hole. I have a blanket made from his favorite superhero t-shirts that I can touch to remember him. One of his few pleasures was water therapy, also known as tubby time, because the warm water helped lessen the strain on his lungs and limbs. So I've kept his hooded Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles towel. If I'm feeling far from him, I'll put it on and wear it around the house. I've even cuddled it in bed. It feels good, and it connects me to something tangible that's still here, still present with me. I wore it while I wrote this, and I'm wearing it right now while I read this. But by far my favorite touchstone is a medallion with his thumbprint that I wear around my neck. I only take it off to shower, and the simple act of putting it back on, as frustrating as the minuscule clasp is, connects me to him and makes me feel like I'm putting on my Finn armor. He is with me. He is safe. He is here. Together, we face a new day. In my studio, I have objects to spur me forward and keep me focused on telling stories. Through a window in my recording booth, I can see a picture of us together. His eyes are bright blue as he looks directly into the camera, and he has a Superman and Batman figurine clenched in each sweaty hand. I also have my grandfather Charles Muselix Daniels fedora in my studio. Too small to fit my head, why are we so much bigger than people from the past? But it's there to remind me to appreciate those who came before and set the stage for me. I've put up superhero posters from my childhood all over the walls to inspire me to keep fighting, to keep going, and not give up even when all hope seems lost. And then, in the corner of my studio, are the giant red shoes with yellow laces. If tangible objects can hold weight for me and help shoulder my burden, so too do dogs. God, I love dogs. I've always had one. One of my earliest memories is of laying on our family dog in our living room and napping with the sun shining in from a window. I can remember her soft black fur and the warmth from splintered sunbeams and also from my dog's body. This warmth was suffused with her breath as she breathed in and out, and my head rose and fell. Like Nanny from Peter Pan, she made me feel comforted, safe and content. It's the same memory I tried to give Finn with his golden retriever, Jasper. After Finn passed, I got a new puppy to help give me that physical sensation of holding something alive again,
He's a Shih Tzu named Tucker, and he weighs almost exactly as much as Finn did. There is still a physical need left over after losing Finn. That parental need to care for and comfort doesn't end when a child dies. So, I find it helps to act out those needs with Tuck. I hold him how I used to hold Finn. And I close my eyes, and I feel his weight, and pat his furry butt, and I tell him he's a very, very good boy. And that his daddy is so very, very proud of him. And it may sound strange, or even delusional, but it helps. It honestly helps. Part 7. February 2016. During Finn. During grad school at the University of Connecticut, I was in a production of the Scottish play as Banquo. Technically, I'm in my sound booth right now and not at a theater, so I could say the M-word. However, I choose not to take a chance on it. I'm a bit of a superstitious fellow. For my entrance into Act 2, Scene 3, I asked the director if I could come in singing Jock McGraw. As part of my research, I've been listening to old Scottish songs, and for whatever reason, that one stuck in my head. The director generously indulged me. In the scene, I'm out in some creepy woods with my son Fleance when we're set upon by assassins. Banquo is murdered, but Fleance escapes. It's a scene that starts softly with playful banter between father and son, but quickly, as in so much of Shakespeare, turns bloody. I often use songs or a piece of text to act as a sort of coat hanger for a character. They provide some structure for me to drape the character over. It's also useful for learning and speaking different dialects and accents. For instance, I can't help but sing Jock McGraw in a Scottish brogue, and the bigger the better. Little did I know that more than 10 years later I would use it as a coat hanger for that dialect when narrating audiobooks. Little did I know that more than 10 years later I would sing the same song to my son. Little did I know that something as seemingly benign as a song could give me strength to get through the hardest moment of my life. I think maybe this is why story, song, and language are so vital to me. Story transports me and connects me to a larger truth, lifting me out of the muck and mire to a more ethereal, heartfelt place. Words are power. They are incantations of breath, voice, and intention. Words are how I've made my living. I've been fortunate enough to be granted a voice. How suitably ironic that my son could never speak. But that's okay, buddy. I will be your voice. Since Finn's passing, I find it difficult to sing Jock McGraw. But I think it is important to push through that and not avoid something because it's painful. It's all painful. However, the lyrics have so much power now that I have to use them carefully. They've become a magic spell that when sounded open a direct line from me to my son and back again. A verbal feedback loop, time machine, interdimensional rocket ship. My whole life, it seems, has been wound around stories. From the tapes I would listen to on my Walkman as I fell asleep, to sitting in rehearsal halls across the country, watching my parents craft theater with an ensemble of like-minded storytellers, to the actual story of my life, which often feels like it has already been written and at the same time a completely chaotic improvisation. Finn's story carries the souls of his family and those his short life touched. It's a story worth speaking, as I believe all stories are. Because once spoken, a story takes on a life of its own. My grandmom is a little girl watching her most precious possessions being burned by someone who should have been protecting her. The ghost of a maid in an old mansion. The girl who watched a clown fail at magic from behind glass. Me, behind glass. A real-life clown in boating shoes and an orange jumpsuit. Each story gets passed down and around. They intertwine and connect, expand and focus.
A story carries the souls and actions of its characters to new ears and new minds. And stories are given new life each time they're told. In that way, stories can be eternal.
It's okay, buddy. You can rest now.
With a cracked and shaking voice, I say this to my son. He lays on his changing table. He is blue-gray and cold. His fight is finally over. I am surrounded by my family. I feel their hands on my back as I slowly and methodically begin cleaning his small and frail body. And I think to myself, I've been looking forward to this moment. Not his death, of course, although I would be lying if I didn't say there was relief that he no longer had to fight so hard, as well as gratitude that his death was easier than his life. No. The moment I've been looking forward to is when I can, at last, take all of the medical devices out of him. The thought of his passing is too much, so I focus instead on this task. I tell him that his body can finally be freed from all the plastic tubes and wires, invasive medical machines that had both helped him and caused him so much pain and suffering. Someone brings warm, soapy water, and I begin giving him his final bath.
Behold, I am a soldier bold, and only 25 years old. A finer warrior ne'er was seen, from Inverness to Gretna Green.
I wash his head, his sweet, beautiful head, starting with his wispy reddish-blonde curls. The suds roll down his face, his parted lips, chapped and cracked, moisten. His nose and round cheeks, which had been so red and scratched from his own fingers, now look almost healed. It feels as if it's some small divine dignity given to him in death. Yet even in this moment I think, no, just a result of his heart not pumping blood through his body. I move on to washing his small, perfect ears. My tears mix with the soapy water. I remind myself to keep breathing. There is still work to do.
When I was young, my father said he'd put me to a decent trade, but I didn't like the work at all. I went and I joined the 42.
Now comes what I've been waiting for. Below his small, pointy chin lies the trach, the small piece of plastic that sits in his airway and keeps the hole open in his throat that the breathing machine hooks up to, although it is no longer hooked up and hasn't been since we began hospice. Now I use my fingers to slide the plastic from his throat, thankful that we will no longer have to go through the terrifying process of cleaning and replacing it every week. Once removed, I clean the hole in his throat and down the sides of his neck to his small shoulders.
There, buddy. Doesn't that feel so much better? No more. No more. You don't need this anymore. You're free, buddy. You're free.
From there, I clean his chest and his stinky pits, his arms and hands and fingers, which look almost translucent. As if bereft of his spirit, his body is slowly fading out of existence. I've been anticipating this next part, too. His tight little tummy and its stomach peg that allowed us to feed him.
No more. No more. No more.
I keep repeating this in a trance. I slide the button out of his stomach for the last time, cleaning the hole, which is raw and chapped like the rest of him. And that's it. Just two small pieces of plastic. With them removed, I look down at my boy, free from all the pain and gadgets, smelling of soap. After cleaning his legs and bum, feet and toes, I take a towel and swaddle him, drying his hair, even as my tears wetted again. At this point, I get him dressed in his favorite Captain America pajamas. Then I'm told that the funeral home has sent its workers to pick up the body. And as we take turns holding him and keening into his soft hair, I realize I will now have to carry him out and give him to some strangers. And that will be it. The funeral director and his pregnant daughter arrive in a converted minivan, which at first seems strange, but now I think helped lessen the blow, as opposed to a giant Adams family hearse showing up at the house, sometimes with child death, discretion is the better part of valor. They are kind and patient as his mother holds him for the last time, rocking back and forth. Finally, I take him and place him in his favorite blanket. It's February in Michigan, and my shattered brain doesn't want him getting cold on the walk out to the van. The sliding door opens, and there's a small gurney. And I think, is this a child's gurney? I didn't know they made child gurneys. Maybe it's not just for children, but for small people. I turn my focus back to the bundle in my arms. He's almost weightless now. I kiss his cheeks, his wonderful, huge chipmunk cheeks, the only part of his body that ever looked healthy. I kiss his lips and can smell death on his breath. His soul has left, but death still lurks in his body, waiting to claim his physical form as well. As I lean down to place him in the van, I fumble with the straps and buckles, and the funeral director kindly leans in to help me. Then I lean over him, kiss him one last time, and shut the door. The wind may blow, the cock may crow, the rain, and the snow may snow, but you will na freight in Jack McGraw. The stoutest man in the 42. I was raised Catholic and went to parochial school, and yet I struggle with the concept of a god. Finn's life and passing have not helped the doubt I've always felt. But I recognize that a lot of times, and especially in grief, when staring into the face of doubt, it's better to believe in something. Belief in something, anything, helps build my hope back up, and it can bring comfort. Hope continues to surprise me, chasing me down, refusing to let me surrender completely to despair. I was given hope by people I didn't even know who donated to his GoFundMe just because they wanted to help. I was given hope by my friends and colleagues who reached out to give me support and time and space during my grief. I was given hope by the people who ran the funeral home, who were so kind and compassionate. I was given hope by his nurses and doctors and all the people who came to honor him that day, bringing so much light in my darkest hours. Slowly, hope is built in my heart again. Immediately after Finn's passing, I set to work on a funeral video of pictures from his life. Many didn't know what had happened to him while we'd been sequestered for 2 years. And I wanted them to know his story. So for 2 days, I sifted through every single photo we had of Finn and made a visual history of his life. Watching his life flash before my eyes in pictures was agonizing, but it felt fitting because, in a way, I died with Finn. And now I had to find a way to keep going as a different person than I was before. I also wanted to speak at the funeral, but what could I say that would be hopeful? A funeral for a baby is already hard enough. I didn't want to dwell over much in the tragedy of his life and death. So I read this very simple poem that I'm sure everyone has heard before. But in light of the circumstances, I hoped it would be heard with fresh ears and felt with open hearts. As I got up to speak in front of his small pink Himalayan salt urn and the dozens of beautiful flowers sent by good and kind people, I looked out and could feel the tension in the air, the uncertain anticipation of those gathered. So I looked into their wide, expectant eyes,
and I told everyone to breathe together. And they laughed and let out the breaths they didn't know they'd been holding, and we all breathed together for a moment. So let's do the same. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. One more time. Breathe in. Breathe out. Try, Try Again by William Edward Hickson. It's a lesson you should heed. Try, try again. If at first you don't succeed, try, try again. Then your courage should appear. For if you will persevere, you will conquer, never fear. Try, try again. Once or twice, though you should fail, try, try again. If you would at last prevail, try, try again. If we strive, 'tis no disgrace, though we do not win the race, what should you do in that case? Try, try again. If you find your task is hard, try, try again. Time will bring you your reward. Try, try again. All that other folk can do, why, with patience, should not you? Only keep this rule in view. Try, try again. Epilogue. Hi, buddy. A cardinal has come to give me the morning report, its tweets and trills soothing during this early morning hour as I sip my coffee and prepare for the day's recording. I miss you. Three simple words bring me right back to him. Instead of a touchstone, I call these talk stones. Words that can elicit strong emotion, as well as a feeling of connectivity to someone I've lost and so desperately want to be with. There are tall trees and dappled sunlight back here. A wind chime tinkles out a few notes, and I hold him in my heart while I take in the world around me. You see that birdie? Isn't he a pretty red color? Today is another in the list of dates that hold meaning for me. Today, I start to record his story for you. Today, I will memorialize him through spoken words. No longer will his story be unspoken. In my studio, I see the faces of Captain America, Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man, and they're cheering me on. The red shoes with yellow laces do a tap dance for me. The birds outside start up a chorus of support. I sit in my chair. I put on my headphones, and I look at the words in front of me. Then I pause. I look out the window of my booth, and I see his face. He's looking right back at me with big, clear blue eyes. He's got Batman and Superman in a death grip. And for the first time, I hear his voice. Tell me a story, Dada. Okay, buddy. I got one I think you'll like. Turning back to the words, I take a breath, and I begin. This has been an Audible Original, produced by Audible Originals, written and performed by Luke Daniels, executive producers Rachel Smalter Hall, Maggie Murphy, and Kat Lambrix, edited, mixed, and mastered by John Dracy. Traditional song Jock McGraw performed by Barley Juice. Traditional song Will Ye Go Laddie performed by John Dracy and Asni Vigisa. Acquisition and development Joanne Peretz. Vice President of Audible Studios Mike Charzik. Editor-in-Chief Audible Original Publishing David Blum. Copyright 2020 by Luke Daniels. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.